Hello, I'm Peter Deegan, the lead tutor for the RSSL Auditing Career Pathway. Welcome to the next podcast in our series of My Auditing Journey. These interviews are aimed at talking with auditors from across industry to gain from their knowledge and their experience in auditing. This is an important part of any auditor's continuing professional development activities to learn from others. Today, I'll be interviewing Sue Mann, who is also my co-tutor on the RSSL Lead Auditor course. So it's going to be fun for both of us once again to reflect on our auditing experiences so we can keep paying it forward to the next generation of auditors. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you very much, Peter.
It would be good, Sue, for those listening to hear your background in the pharmaceutical industry and how you started in auditing.
My background in the industry came straight from university to do a joint pre-reg scheme where pre-registration scheme for pharmacists. And that involved 6 months working in industry, and I chose 6 months in hospital as the other, because you have to during, or we had to at that time, be able to actually dispense, which of course you cannot do typically in an industrial situation. And then luckily I was offered a job back at the company that I'd started with during that pre-reg, and went forward from there. So pharmacist, straight into industry, but with some hospital experience. And after I'd registered, with some locum to experience working in the retail, the community environment as well. So I feel I have a good connection with the patient at the end of the day. And I think actually that's something that we always got to bear in mind when we're auditing. First started auditing, I think I can remember it actually, just thrown in at the deep end and asked to do an internal audit. And I tried to ask, well, what is the process? What should happen? Will you just go and do it, basically? Absolutely. I mean, absolutely classic way that would seem to be the norm, or relatively the norm at that time. And so did one and just thought, this does not feel at all as if I've actually achieved anything apart from ticking a box that I've actually done an audit, but I don't think it's been of much benefit to people, et cetera, et cetera. So then started to move that forwards in saying, well, shouldn't we have a process for this? And what should that process look like so that we can maximize the benefit of any audit? Well, that was an internal audit, or I guess we'd call it a first party audit. And then I had a sort of, I suppose, a surreal parallel experience for my first, or one of my first, I think it was actually my second, external audit, which again, second party audit, which again was, so we've already chosen this company to do some packing for us for a large job because we can't manage it. We don't have the capacity in-house. Please go and audit them, you know, in inverted commas, to confirm that they're okay. So, you know, there it was. It was like a sat-nav audit, as we'd call it these days. You know, they had already assumed the answer, and I was going to confirm that their choice of that particular contractor was suitable. So, again, it was one of those ones where, you know, you go and do it because you're literally told one afternoon and you're off in your car the next morning. But after that, when I came back, I just said, you know, in my politest way, that never again, you know, that is not the way, it can't be the way to do audits. I know even if people have to do a for cause audit, that there has to be enough prep so that you can actually manage that audit and focus on whatever you need to look at. So this was to me no different. It was just a different scope.
It's an interesting point you raise about the procurement process. They've already selected the supplier. And what's the value that you're adding as an auditor? I was very similar in my experiences where it was a Friday afternoon. My manager said, we've got a problem with a supplier in a particular country. I haven't got time to go. Can you go out with the commercial director and can you just do an audit on us? Okay, fine. And we went out on the plane and I sat next to the commercial director and he says, it's not going to affect any outcome, this audit, is it? And I was I'd only just been with the company for about 6 months. I'd only just graduated in my chemistry degree. I didn't really understand or know commercial pharmaceutical quality systems and GMP as such. So that was a veiled threat in some ways to say, do your job, but it doesn't affect the outcome. And I think that's an interesting history that we've both got together in that regard.
That's right. And I don't think mine was, I don't think it was meant as a threat. It was just that they'd realized they'd got themselves in a corner. It was one of these tender jobs. So there was a massive penalty if they failed to deliver on time. Realized at the 11th hour, of course, that they didn't have the capacity to do the packaging operations. And that's when they knew they needed to outsource. And so I think it was more in my situation, it was more a knee-jerk reaction, but similar in the sense of, but we've already made the decision, you know, now go and add the report that sort of justifies it or rubber stamps it, I suppose, as being okay. Yeah.
And that brings into our ISO IRCA level lead auditor course, where we put a lot of emphasis in the early part of the training course on roles and responsibilities of management. This is part of a procurement process. I'm not a decision maker on the business side of the venture. And the assessment, my role is to assess safety, efficacy, and quality capability of your organization.
Absolutely. And what I suppose I'm proud of or pleased about is that as I've gone through the industry and worked for different companies, I got to the point pretty quickly where I've made sure as either head of quality or somebody with sufficient seniority, let's put it that way, that I've said in any process, including due diligence, when we're looking at companies or to buy products from a company, that the quality input and the auditing input as part of the quality department's role in that due diligence audit has to be sufficient and early enough, and that you know, you can't make decisions and then as an afterthought ask quality to go and perform an audit. It just doesn't work in that way, because either outcome is not acceptable for the company, to be honest.
This brings into nicely ICHQ10 and its purpose. The origins of ICHQ10 are to bring the ISO 9000 series of management responsibility, continuous improvement. And I'm just an auditor. I'm a small part in a big wheel. Well, without you as a part, that wheel isn't going to turn around anyway. So it's a fundamentally important role. It has legitimacy and it has a decision-making capability. And when I audit organizations at the pharmaceutical quality system level, that management level, I look about what is management's view on auditing. Is it just as a sunk cost or is it an opportunity cost?
And I think you raise a great point there, because I think a lot of organisations see auditing, especially internal auditing or first party audits, as something that, well, we have to do it because the GMPs tell us we have to do it, or the GXPs, it's not just the GMPs, but it's a tick box exercise. And there isn't enough emphasis on those audits, because if you think about it, if we were doing those internal audits well, then when a regulatory inspector comes to view our company or a potential client, depending what organization you work for, then they should not find anything significant. That, you know, they might find one or two little things. Of course they might. Everything's a sampling exercise, but they shouldn't find anything significant. So it calls into question the robustness of the internal, particularly the internal audit process in many companies, when they seem to have a surprise and get caught out when the regulatory inspector comes along and says, well, actually, you've got these major deficiencies and here they are.
And I've had the conversation with a senior manager post an inspection saying, why didn't anybody tell me?
Absolutely. And that senior manager may need to reflect on, did I actually do anything to promote somebody telling me that? Did I get myself involved enough so I did have that awareness of what was going well, what wasn't going so well. And you're absolutely right. But, you know, I think we're learning as an industry, but I think the GMPs in particular, or the GXPs, are behind in the sense that they tell us to audit, but until you look at the ISO and the ISO auditing standard, then you don't have the detail of how to audit, let me just say it, properly.
I think you're right, and the roles and responsibilities are explicitly defined. The audit client is the organisation commissioning the audit, and that's management.
Absolutely.
And it's not necessarily just funding and budgeting, it's resourcing, and it's owning the outcome, particularly in the self-inspection outcomes. Self-inspection may be regarded as a low-level type audit, but it's the fundamental ability of management to be provided with assurance or verification that their quality system is well-founded. That brings into Annex 16, 1.7, the qualified person has to rely on the fact that others are performing their duties and that assurance must be well-founded. So you've done a few audits, you're starting to gain a bit of speed and a bit of traction. What were the big learning points as you started to develop your competence in auditing in those early days, Sue?
Well, I mean, I have never counted up, but I must have done hundreds of audits over 40 years in the pharmaceutical industry. And I think I quickly learned that, back to that basic saying about proper preparation and proper planning prevents poor performance. So knowing not only what you're auditing, as in the scope of the audit. Yes, people say, go and visit this site or go and look at that packing operation or whatever it is. But knowing the standards and being confident that you do know those standards, so can call them out if required during the audit. But also doing your homework about the company, the site, the previous audit, anything else, talking to other people within the organisation to find out whether there have been any other issues. So for me, it's again being a critical or a key cog in that supply chain wheel sort of thing. So being able to take information saying, well, actually the quality's okay when the material arrives, but we don't tend to get it when they say they're going to send it. We don't always get in full the delivery that we're expecting, and things like that, and be able to sort of feed that back into understanding where to perhaps focus on a particular audit or certain questions anyway. I think I learned a lot about that, and that preparation helping the audit, so that I started off having not a checklist, but I would say a relatively comprehensive aid memoir. Now that I've done so many audits, I can probably reduce that aid memoir to some keywords or key phrases, which just remind me some of the critical points I want to make sure I cover in my sampling exercise, because that's what it is. I think the other critical thing I learned, and we'll perhaps talk about this if we talk about Africa, is that write up the audit reports as soon as possible afterwards. Not necessarily on the plane. I am not interested in doing that for lots of reasons, including I'm usually tired and I just need to reflect before I start writing up the report, but to write them up as quickly as possible, because a lot of us have a reasonable visual memory as well as our notes, but it's making sure that visual memory doesn't then fade over time, and then you go and look at your notes and realize that you don't quite understand what you've written somewhere. So for me, I didn't really suffer from that particularly, but I think that's because I had the discipline of writing up reports quickly.
I love that visual memory point. I never really thought of it like that. One has a factual verification objective evidence process as part of your auditing. I really like what you say about that memory, visual memory. The brain sometimes overwrites what memory it thinks it saw or thinks it heard or thought it smelled. And I think that's really good to have that in your short-term memory to capture those moments. In all our auditing courses, we put reliance on obtaining objective evidence. And objective evidence, as ISO defines it, is the truth or existence or verity of something. So we are factually driven, but I really like that visual memory component to help you augment what the truth actually was.
And I think what it does for me is when I'm looking at my notes and writing up a report, I actually kind of transport myself back into that room, back into that area. And I can see it as I'm writing up the report, if you see what I mean. I'm obviously having to write down the factual information, whether I'm describing something or whether I'm detailing a nonconformity. You know, I'm using that sort of visual memory. And it can be also, as you say, it's pretty much all the senses. I don't sort of touch a lot of things when I'm auditing, or, you know, not the product anyway, but the smell, the sight, the sounds, and just, you know, sometimes you're aware of something, aren't you? That, you know, it could be something touching me in the sense of all of a sudden there's quite a blast of airflow. Well, where on earth that come from? Is the HVAC balanced? You know, all of that. When something like that happens, or I put my hand or a piece of paper against a door and I'm looking to see if the paper's going to either be sucked to the door, if that's what I'm expecting with a pressure differential, or sort of wafted and blown away from the door surface. So again, it's using all those different senses to pick up that factual information, which then gets written and detailed in the report.
The FDA are now using this quality maturity model to assess the maturity or the quality culture of an organization. And I think that sensing, rather than everybody was doing their job correctly, but there was something that wasn't quite right, as a, you know, caricature example of the audit, you have a judgment to make about assessment of quality culture. Sometimes the facts are one component of that objective evidence, and you've got to feel the place.
That's right. But then you've got to try and look for, or see if you can find a sort of deficiency or nonconformity to hang that on, because otherwise it's your opinion, your feeling about something which is not acceptable in an audit report. Might be in a very open conversation at some stage with the company and perhaps with their quality department, if those are the only ones that have the quality culture and the rest of the site doesn't seem to think that quality impacts them or affects them at all, or is relevant to them. And I have been to some sites like that where the quality department is literally running themselves ragged because there is very poor quality culture in that organization or in that site, and no one else seems to think it's their responsibility or even that they should be involved. That quality determines quality. Well, no, actually, that's not really the case. Quality can only confirm what you as production have done and put into things, or you in the QC lab, how careful you've been, if you've followed the method properly, and then we can rely upon the result that you've got.
So how do you gain objective evidence of quality culture?
For me, it's really looking around the people, the interaction, the responsibilities, and seeing if I can see something there in the organisation. I mean, maybe literally you can find something in the training. And so it's factual because you can see that for certain departments, certain people, certain levels, they really get very little, if any. I mean, they probably get some because it's, you know, it's a regulatory expectation, but sort of paying lip service to quality culture, GMP, the expectations. It's much more, well, you're in here to be a production operator, therefore I'll train you to do the job and you don't need to ask any other questions. Just get on and do the job. And the poor person or people in that department have no idea what they're doing. I mean, physically, operationally, they have an idea of what they're doing. Of course they do. But they don't understand the importance of it. They don't relate it and link it to the fact there's a patient at the end of the day, that quality is something that they're building in to the product that they're making, whatever stage of the process they're at. And you cannot test quality in at the end.
There's a really nice theory I once learned called espoused theory and theory in use. Espoused theory is what you say you do and theory and use is what you actually do. And there's a dichotomy there, usually between the management and QA, or management or QA and production, because it has to be an harmoniously understood quality culture. It can't be polarized, them and us. And today's modern environment, and particularly ICHQ 10, European GMP Chapter 1, pharmaceutical quality system and the requirements of the qualified person, should be able to articulate that in a structured process now, really, I think. But again, it's that how do you assess harmony is a real challenge as an auditor.
I agree. It's not an easy one. And for that reason, I think a lot of auditors, even though they know there's a quality culture issue in that company, don't ever actually end up writing anything in the report that clearly states that, because they feel that perhaps it's on a, I don't know, sensitive ground, difficult to put an objective evidence around it, and therefore a finding. And so I think, you know, as auditors, you've got to have your facts, but then you've got to be brave enough to actually make sure you write them. And at the closing meeting, again, often it's not what you're telling them, you know, the bad news, these are all the findings. It's how you tell it. And you can tell it in a very negative way that says, basically, the underlying message is you're getting everything wrong in this company. Or that people are trying to do the right thing, and maybe the organization, maybe the structure, maybe some of the systems are not supporting them and helping them do the right thing. And what I found as well is that I can hopefully motivate people, even in quite a negative situation, to actually want to make it better, to want to improve things. Again, you've got to have buy-in from management, but if you've got that on the site and they've realized that that's something they've let slip, then, you know, as an auditor, you can feel very proud that your work is hopefully going to have long-term benefit at that organization.
I think there is a great challenge in the internal auditing environment, self-inspection environment, because it is with you're looking at your own company, and you may be auditing people who are your friends, your work colleagues, your social colleagues, and to call out improvement needs in quality culture is quite a task to do because of that emotional perspective to it. One of RSSL's most popular courses is the internal auditor course, and we actually do quite a lot of in-house training. So we train a whole team at the same time. That allows them to be more consistent. They've got an understanding core process commonality. But I explore that as the tutor in character in the roles in the audit case study exercises about that potential emotional conflict that they've got. And they don't realize that that's an issue, because they've got to be factual and accurate and honest. That mitigates the emotional side very much.
That's right. And it can be done, you know, and it needs to be done. And we know that where there is what is felt to be a sort of conflict or a very difficult situation, then assuming the organisation is big enough, you might choose a different auditor to get involved in that particular internal audit or first party audit, just to make sure from the organization's point of view, you're maximizing the benefit of that time and that money spent doing that work.
I now want to explore other areas where perhaps the auditing was more challenging or the scope was more difficult to achieve. I know that you've done a lot of work in Africa with UNIDO. I wonder if you could explain what your role was and what the purpose of the audit program was for UNIDO.
And just maybe to put this into context, UNIDO being the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, or that branch of the United Nations, they have a number of sectors where they're trying to support different industries, different organizations, different sectors within developing countries. And I was within one of the sectors that was trying to move a project for improving the quality of medicines being manufactured in country, so in these individual countries, so that they could apply for WHO accreditation with the World Health Organization, so that as a result of that, and so this was a long-term project, the idea being that that would give them, it would give obviously the patients and the government within that country more reassurance about the quality of the medicines, but also give each company a bigger, much bigger opportunity to export. Because what you find is there's a hierarchy of countries that companies can export to. And depending on the rigor and the thoroughness of their own national or regional regulatory authorities, then they typically can export to equivalent or slightly less rigorous. So once you've got down to some of these countries, which are still developing with fairly young regulatory agencies, it has to be said limited experience, just because they've not been necessarily around for that many years, then their export opportunities are fairly limited at the moment. So it was a sort of, I'm going to say, a stick and carrot approach, if I use it very simplistically, because the carrot at the end, of course, was this opportunity for increased trade. The stick was kind of, well, actually, the regulatory authority within that country is going to start to enforce the standards in a more strict way. And so therefore, some of you, really, if you're not going to be part of this program, could find yourself left behind. So there was all that going on behind the scene. And what they had done was created what they called a roadmap, which obviously was this journey to get these companies from where they were to where they needed to be. And so the idea being that a very small number of auditors, we call GMP experts, three of us, would go in, do an initial assessment and kind of gap analysis in these companies, and then help them create a CAPA plan, and then go in at whatever time later, so it could be months, it could be a year later, whatever, to see how they were improving and try and keep them on this journey. And so for me, it was very exciting, but very challenging, because as individual auditors, we needed to be as consistent with each other as possible, because we were grading these sites. And that was important to understand where their start point was, and therefore how big the gaps were they needed to complete. The other, I guess, added challenge, some people would call it, I just called it an opportunity, because I actually found it very interesting, was that there was a sort of, I think you'd call it a purdah, wouldn't you? When the regulatory inspectors said, and part of the UNIDO remit and philosophy was, actually the regulatory inspectors would also benefit from seeing us carrying out some of these assessments. So they should join us on these particular assessments. So sometimes I had a GMP inspector who had never been to that site before, and other times I had a GMP inspector who had perhaps been to that particular site not that long ago. So quite an interesting situation for them to be in as well. And so the idea being that they shadowed us, they could ask us questions, not to interrupt the audit, but were part of it as an observer, so that there hopefully was going to be some additional learning, understanding of perhaps some of the audit skills that we brought to the project. So I found that quite interesting, because there were times when I was talking to, say, the quality head, there were times when I was talking to the company owner, because a lot of these are privately owned companies. So of course, you know, looking at the business side as well as the GMP side and trying to balance things, I had inspectors with me at sometimes perhaps feeling slightly awkward, let's be honest, because I was perhaps uncovering certain things that it was fair to say were probably there at the time they last did their inspection. But let's just assume that wasn't in their sampling exercise, shall we? And also then we had meetings with government officials as well. So ministers of health and the departments and the great and the good around there, plus these the sort of pharmaceutical organisations, the trade organisations, perhaps I should call them, in the different countries. So there were some quite interesting situations where diplomacy skills came to the fore. So again, this is picking up on our earlier thought process around sometimes not, it's not what you say, but it's how you say it. It will be how accepted that is, or whether it's accepted or not. And I found that in Africa, in those various countries, there is a different way of working. It is a different pace. You have to just kind of go with it. But that I could get my points across in a hopefully polite, diplomatic, but firm enough way for the people that needed to know what the situation was, what it actually was. So we didn't really pull our punches that much when it came to letting government know what was happening within their country, whereas perhaps with the inspectorate, with the individual inspectors, that was a different relationship. But with the head of the inspectorate in some countries, they were also, that individual was also saying, tell me it, the good, the bad, and the ugly of what's actually going on. Because obviously they're only getting the feedback from their troops, from the inspectors that are actually out in the field. So quite challenging from that point of view. The audits covered two main areas, and we had this very detailed sort of roadmap of issues that, that we could find and how we graded them within that. A lot of work had been done to create that, to try and help the three of us be as consistent as possible. The two areas were the premises, equipment, plus you can add into that all the utilities. And then the other aspect was the pharmaceutical quality system. So we didn't ever look at things like development or what have you got in any registration dossiers, because in some countries, those are perhaps fairly rudimentary at the moment. So that, you know, it's another one of these evolutionary stages that these countries are going to go through. In some of those situations, I was the only female in the room. That was perfectly normal in most of the companies. There were a number of women working in different companies, and some companies had some women in some reasonably senior posts. But some companies, it was, if you wanted to spot the women, you needed to look on the packing floor. I'm sorry, but that's where you needed to look. And that's quite an interesting situation, obviously, as a woman out there. I used to typically have an in-country UNIDO kind of rep who would join me, take me to the sites, pick me up from most of the sites. That was very useful because, again, sometimes at the beginning, even though a company had said, yes, we've agreed to having this audit, this assessment for these 2 days, and we know when you're going to arrive. When we did arrive physically, it seemed a bit of a surprise to them. So it was great to have somebody who spoke their language and could basically make sure that everything was sorted out so we could actually get started. So challenging in other ways, in the sense that each visit tended to be 2 weeks and each assessment 2 days. So I was doing literally 5 assessments in 10 days at different companies. Hence my comment about, well, making good notes and writing up your audit reports as quickly as possible, because otherwise that was going to be a difficult thing that would have tested my visual memory, I think, if I'd left it weeks later when I got back home and tried to start writing them up then. But fantastic experience, quite challenging. We had some training at the beginning where we observed one of the three auditors who had been doing work for UNIDO in a specific country, and now they were broadening out the project. And great, great mentor for learning and calibrating really where he was coming from for the items that were deficiencies, no problem. I think we were all aligned on that. But the criticality sometimes just maybe we weren't quite aligned. So it was good to have that sanity check before we went out on our own.
So I would like to explore standards and audit criteria in our ISO IRCA lead auditor course. We put a lot of emphasis on what standards are you auditing against, and in countries with, shall we say, a competent authority or competent regulatory framework, Europe, US, etc., we have very clear, explicit regulations and guidances against which we audit. How did you approach the standards and guidances to audit against in those African countries?
Good question, because many of them don't have their own guidelines as such. So they tend to lean on the WHO guidelines, which fortuitously, in a lot of respects, are very similar to the EU with the approach, the thinking, the philosophy around what is required. I think where the WHO guidance and their technical standard or technical series documents, that where they perhaps are even more helpful is they don't necessarily assume a certain level of knowledge or understanding about things. So they'll take something and strip it back down to the sort of basics, whether it's a water system, whether it's equipment, whatever, and sort of build up the layers and the levels of control and management of those systems, whatever it is, or processes. And so the WHO was absolutely the standard that we went to. And of course, within that technical series, they have a number of standards for different topics. And so we use the relevant ones.
I did a lot of training in Malaysia and Indonesia and other Asian countries about 10 years ago. And I was quite surprised. I'd worked for a major pharmaceutical company. It was all classic FDA, EU, Japan. And I was taken by surprise at how much the World Health Organization GMP standards are adhered to and set as standards. But what I also liked about them is that they're fit for purpose. They've got very clear standards on water production systems, on HVAC production systems, because they recognize the environment, the zone two, zone three, zone fours of our world, climatic zones, tropical zones, that are fit for purpose. As Westerners, shall we say, we easily rely on the classic competent standards, but there are many countries who need the World Health Organization standards. And if you read the World Health Organization guidances, you can very clearly see most countries have got a classic GMP structure, but it's really useful, really fit for purpose for those regions.
Absolutely. And it's things like, you know, understanding that in some of those countries, they have power cuts. You know, not necessarily regularly, but they have power cuts. We rarely have power cuts in the UK, or something flickers and then the power comes back on. They have power cuts for quite a long time. The infrastructure isn't there for support. For if they buy a piece of, classic would be a laboratory equipment, but it also production equipment, that you can buy the equipment or the instrument, but then when something breaks on it or something needs repair or whatever, you can't get the spare parts because there aren't companies providing the spare parts in country, not necessarily even in within region. So they're having to import those, and they're really expensive, but they also take a long time to import. And then you know, some of the sort of basic things we take for granted, like being able to buy pre-prepared media or agar plates, say for your microbiology work. They often can't do that. And so they're having to prepare their own. Now, you know, we used to do that. We can still do it, but we may choose not to because it's easier sometimes to buy it in. So there's all this background. The other thing for a lot of these countries and companies is there is no printed packaging or other packaging material supplier in country. There is no API manufacturer in country, and there's probably little or no excipient manufacturers in country. So again, they're importing a lot of these materials or components, and of course they're trying to make it cost effective. So they're trying to import large quantities. It doesn't always work because then they get stuck in customs and all sorts of delays happen. So it really is quite a challenging environment for them. And so what I've also found really rewarding for me was it grounded me. It grounded me in the sense of we can get a little bit carried away with GMPs in the sense that technically and scientifically, we can do all sorts of wonderful things. This made me think, what do we need to do? What do they need to have to produce cost-effective, adequate quality? I don't need it gold-plated, but adequate quality medicines that are going to be safe and effective when they're used by local population. And that, for me, just like reset or recalibrated some of my brain and, well, what's nice to have versus what's a requirement was a very interesting sort of angle of that work that I did.
When we train auditees at any level, be it internal auditor level, lead auditor level, we put a lot of emphasis on bias and personal judgment and personal experience. They don't manufacture the way I expect them to manufacture. And I think this is coming in as a let's just say, working for a company that's auditing a second party supply chain organization that may be anywhere in the world that works to different standards. This is why it's important to set very clear audit criteria and say, show me how you're meeting that, rather than I expect you to do it this way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I saw things and thought, oh my goodness, I either haven't seen one of these for very many years, or I actually have never seen this and never seen the way that this produces this or does that. So show me what it does. And of course, at the back of my mind, is that equivalent? Is that fit for purpose? Is what I was looking for. And you're absolutely right. And I would say, you know what they say about a number of countries where you don't have the money and perhaps don't have the infrastructure, you've got to be more creative. So I saw some very creative solutions for water systems, all sorts of things, let's put it that way. And some of them were okay, some of them, quite frankly, were not okay, but not to worry. But at least they tried, you know, to do something and maybe hadn't understood everything about the system and the requirements for the system. But yes, it's very important that you don't go in as an auditor thinking, well, they don't do it my way or the way I used to do it when I was working for, you know, X company, therefore it must be wrong. What they do must be wrong. That's absolutely not the way to do it, and would not have got me very far during this wonderful opportunity in Africa.
My first job in the pharmaceutical industry was as a graduate QC analyst in a generics company, and we didn't have test specs. We opened up the British Pharmacopeia, and it was, that's what we tested it against. And I remember my QA manager was a very experienced pharmacist, and we were developing a HPLC system for one particular assay. And I remember this was many years ago. I said to him, I said, why doesn't the pharmacopeia update its monograph so that to do this HPLC? And he said, the role of the pharmacopeia is to have a consistent and robust test that can be applied consistently and appropriately anywhere in the world, be that a major global pharmaceutical organization or a hospital pharmacy in Malawi. That really has always stuck with me as both an auditor and as a chemist in the industry, to say, okay, you can do it with more modern technology, but the minimum pharmacopeia requirements must be adhered to. And I think it's your role as an auditor and skill as an auditor to interpret how the organization is presenting their case, rather than judging what you think their case should be. And therefore, that's a non-conformance because you're not doing it how I do it.
And I think a classic for me is environmental monitoring, because you can see facilities where you do not believe that the environmental monitoring perhaps is sufficient, or the locations have been chosen carefully enough. And for me, it's reserved judgment until I've seen the results. And then if I look at the results, I can see that with some of these water systems, make sure the testing that's been done has been obviously appropriate. But then I look at the results and sometimes I think, well, the results actually demonstrate they do have this under control. Whereas your initial impression, not based on fact, of course, but based on what you're seeing at the time, but not completing the picture, is that probably they don't have it under control, or possibly they don't. And so as auditors, it's very important. Anything like that, we follow up with factual evidence.
An area I'd like to explore, Sue, is your experience being a lone female auditor. We've got great opportunities for diversity in our industry today, but in previous years, it must have been quite a challenge to you. What can others learn from you as a lone female auditor to make sure that you are regarded, understood, respected, and safe?
Good question, Peter. And I guess I have seen a sort of evolution, I must admit, since I joined the industry over 40 years ago. I think in the beginning, especially being a young female as well, going out auditing, possibly I wasn't initially considered to be professional, to be knowledgeable, to be serious really about what I was doing. Hopefully I could disabuse most companies and most sites of that fairly quickly. I think what I've learned is you need to be sufficiently assertive, always professional, always diplomatic and polite, despite how sometimes, I was going to say I've been treated, but certainly people have passed comments, made little remarks that I've just chosen to ignore because they were inappropriate. I think as a traveller, I mean, you know, particularly females, but actually these days, I think as a traveller, you have to be savvy about where you are, if you're on your own, if you're in a hotel, perhaps deciding you want to go out for a walk. I like to go for a walk. I like sometimes to go for a jog. There have been places where I've definitely been advised not to, not even to go out of the hotel. And so you just have to accept that in certain places you are restricted, but I don't think that's particularly, not exclusively gender specific, I must admit. I think I've been lucky enough to have training in various companies I've worked for lots of travel advice, for the things that can happen during travel, you know, when they're flight decides to get cancelled and, well, what happens next and all of that, to actually your own safety. I have to say the UNIDO training I had to do before I was allowed to go in country for the first time was incredible. I mean, it was so thorough. It was a series of online training courses with an assessment at the end that I had to pass each time. And it was pretty tough, I can tell you. I have learnt about things that I hope I will never need, because the training was for anyone basically going out to different parts of the world. So we can think of some of the hotspots at the moment. So I got training on recognising what might be a minefield and what to do if I find myself somehow there, which was interesting, slightly scary, but hopefully, as I say, I won't need to put it into practice. But I got some incredible practical experience for traveling on my own, using local hotels, where to eat, you know, how to try and close things down when you want to. I mean, my famous one is I take a book with me, or I take some paper, something to read in the restaurant. And then I'm absorbed with that. So that really is my signal to people that, no, I don't want to be disturbed. I don't want you to start a conversation with me. And I'm definitely not going to talk to a stranger, kind of thing. But also, a lot of the training was about the individual in country, but also how you dealt with your colleagues but also other organisations or other people you would meet and need to work with or deal with in country. And I have to say that training was absolutely superb.
I think there's another element of personal health and well-being as well as security and diversity. I put a lot of emphasis on that now. I'm not getting any younger, and it's harder when you do travel, and jet lag and fatigue can be overwhelming sometimes. So look after your health and well-being and your own personal environment as well as one's security environment as well. It's a role, it's a job, but there is a really important balance that you've got to make. Take time to relax, take time to think, take time to reflect, as you said, rather than just be fully switched on all the time, which is incredibly fatiguing because it's a very technically stimulating job.
It is. And I think it's because of that that I get a buzz out of it and I really enjoy it. And I feel like what I'm doing is identifying areas for improvement in a company and areas where I can help them tangibly really improve their compliance, to a different level. And especially with the UNIDO project, because we'd rated them and sort of did this gap analysis at the beginning. And a lot of them, I don't think surprisingly, didn't necessarily score that well at the beginning. Some were pretty good, but some majority of them perhaps were not quite so good. But going back months or nearly a year later, was able to see absolute improvements. And, I just think I was sort of beaming like some Cheshire cat at one stage, because it was so rewarding that they had moved on this journey and they knew they were getting better. They felt proud about it rather than slightly embarrassed to show me things. And it was a journey that, unfortunately, I didn't see the end of it, but a journey they promised they would continue on. And so let's hope some of them have now become WHO accredited. That would be fantastic news.
That's continuous improvement manifest, isn't it, as an example?
Absolutely. And it is so lovely to feel like you've been part of it. And I know the feedback that I got from a number of the companies I worked with was that I was enthusiastic and I was very positive, even in, how should I say, adverse situations where they knew they had things that were not acceptable and they'd sort of got away with it for a certain length of time. But again, the government and the Department of Health or the Health Minister was saying, we are going to draw a line in the sand on this and you need to be the right side of that line, companies, otherwise you won't exist because we won't renew your licence to be able to manufacture. So, they were getting this extra support that from UNIDO, three of us out there working very hard, I must admit, to really help them.
I think that is a perfect definition of the role of an auditor, to help organisations improve continuously. I think gone are the caricature auditors, I'm coming in to find a deficiency. That's what I'm looking for. And audit reports only contain the deficiencies. Particularly at the IRCA lead auditor level, we put a lot of emphasis and we pay forward our experience and advice to the next generation of auditees to look positively to an audit. It's a legitimate role. It's a beneficial role to our end customer, the patient. And getting it right should be highly rewarding and you should be very motivated at the outcome. Whether the outcome is a critical observation, you've helped an organisation turn back its mirror on itself and give them the opportunity to improve for our patients. And what better role than that?
Absolutely. I love auditing. It's hard work and it can be challenging, but it is so stimulating and so rewarding. I just think it's a fantastic part of what we can do in the industry.
Sue, thank you very much for an incredibly engaging and enlightening conversation today, particularly of your experiences in the UNIDO environment and helping us understand the diversity of organisations and countries in auditing, particularly helping us understand what good looks like, no matter where you are. As I always say in these podcasts, we could talk for hours and hours and hours, and it's just a great conversation. So we thank you for your insights today and paying it forward today. If you would like to learn any more information about RSSL's auditing courses, we have now published the Auditor Career Pathway, which is about continuing professional development beyond the training course. This is what these podcasts are aiming to do, is help you as a listener gain from our insight as experienced auditors. Webinars coming along on specific specialist areas and the like. So thank you for your time today, Sue. I'm looking forward to running the next IRCA Lead Auditor course with you very soon and keeping paying it forward for the next generation of auditors. Thank you for your time today, Sue.
Thank you.